1998. This is Gordon Poehler interviewing Lars Larsen at the Digafognak camp on Afognak Island. Okay, if I hold this, I
no, think... No, no problem.
First of all, I'd just like to get some background. Could you tell me when and where you were born?
Yes, I was born on Afognak Island, March 23rd, 1923. And my parents were Martin L. Larsen, who was of Norwegian descent. My mother was Nadia Chichenov, and she was a daughter of Paul Chichenov of Afognak, and we had 12 children in the family. I'm the youngest of 12. Three died at early childbirth, premature, so there was only 9 living of us in the family.
Who were your brothers and sisters?
Well, starting with the oldest, my oldest sister and first child living of this 9 was Tina. And she left Afognak to marry a coast and geodetic radio operator and moved to San Diego, California. And so I never knew her when I grew up until she returned to Kodiak when I was 18 years old. My next sister was Rika, and then Phoebe, and then Sonia. My brothers were, Pete was the oldest, then Martin, then Carl Guy, and Neil, and myself. So there was I had 4 brothers and 4 sisters.
Okay, how long did you live in Afognak Village, and when did you leave?
The destiny of my life was dictated by the school system. So the school system only had a 8th grade education curriculum. So when I graduated from the 8th grade, I moved to Kodiak to get my high school. So I was 12 years old. And that would be 4 years of high school in Kodiak. So I was 12 when I left, so I must have left Afognak in 1937, I think.
What are your earliest memories of the village?
Well, my earliest memories, of course, are very pleasant because we had an organized life and very disciplined life, but very pleasant. And my early childhood was based on a large family, and being the youngest, they kind of favored me and spoiled me to a degree. But we had a lot of joyous times in our family, but we all had functions in the family where we were well disciplined for maintaining the home, the firewood, and all the other necessities of life, where we all participated in maintaining this lifestyle that we had. So we had milk cows to milk. We had chicken. So I had to collect eggs. I milked the cows. I dug the clams, and we went fishing. For trout as well as for halibut, cod, and sole. We had a beachfront which actually had oysters too. My dad planted oysters out there. And so we had a real lovely life for natural foods to procure. Plus we had cattle for fresh beef. And we also ate a lot of ducks and geese and other waterfowl. So we had bountiful natural foods, and we had a garden that was so plentiful that we could not eat all the vegetables in one year. So every spring before planting the new garden, it was my job as a young child to clean out the root cellar and throw away all the potatoes and turnips and rutabagas and all the other vegetables we had in the cellar, clean it out, put new dried straw in there for the new crop of vegetables that we would store in there in the month of September. Now, and we left kale. The only thing we didn't take out of the garden during that September harvest was kale, which would survive the frost, and we didn't know that, but it did, and rhubarb survived it too.
Can you describe how the village was laid out?
Yes, we had, Afognak had two villages when I was growing up. One was called Najila, which means village in Russian, and the other end of town was called Aleutown, where the natives lived there. And so we had two distinct settlements. Where we lived, you will notice the architecture of the homes were Nordic in structure and architectural design due to the Nordic influence of the people that lived there, because you will notice that most of the families there had Norwegian and Swedish names. Now there's an Irishman, and there was one Czechoslovakian there, and also one Italian, but the European influence was predominant there. And whereas in Aleutown, the only Barabara that I was aware of during my childhood were two men that Anana and Alapa had Barabaras. But other than that, they also had wooden structured homes, and some of the native carpenters that lived in Aleutown, such as not Tikhon Chertin, but I can't remember his first name now, but he was a well-skilled carpenter and built a lot of the homes there in Aleutown. And we had our own system of cutting lumber. It was an elevated tripod, and the timbers were placed on the upper level, and they have a saw that would go up and down, and they cut their lumber in that fashion. And we had red cedar and yellow cedar in abundance, so consequently most of our houses were built of wood that were self-preserving in its natural content.
So how did your father find his way to Afognak?
That's a question I ask many people, but I really don't have a full story on that. The only thing I know about it is my dad was working on an English ship that came out here to buy salmon from the natives. They would clean it and salt it and put it in barrels and then transport it back to England. So when my dad met my mother, he went back to England and discharged the cargo there. And on the return trip the next spring, he purchased all the furniture for the anticipated plans of marriage. And so we ended up with a house full of Chippendale furniture and bone china and Czechoslovakian cut glassware and Oriental rugs. And so we had a home well furnished for a little village out of nowhere.
You mentioned the two sides of the village. So how did the people on each side refer to themselves, even though a lot of the people on your side of the village were also had native blood, that they considered themselves different from the people on the other side of the village?
Well, I personally did not comprehend the difference. As a child, I had no comprehension of racial lines or our heritage had any effect upon our relationships or our family lifestyle. We accepted them, they accepted us, as far as my context, because my dad could speak the language too. He learned the language, the Ludic language. He spoke seven languages. And he also treated them like he treated anybody else. And my dad would help them. The people in Aleutown, when they were short of food, many times they didn't have fruit, vegetables, or they didn't have meat. and he would be more than willing to share. And we were never told that this person was not acceptable or we should keep away from them or anything. You know, we had a free access to them, and they had a free access to us. And they would come, many of the people from Alyuton would come to our home knowing that they could get help. And my dad was readily available.
What do you remember about the school? Do you remember specific teachers?
Yes. I think some of the teachers that had a great influence on my life were the math teachers and the manual training teachers. When I was in the sixth grade, we actually built a skiff, whereas we planed the lumber. We went up and cut the knees from the trees, shaped them out, and prepared them with the right angularity for the from the bow to the stern. And we knew how to put the framework together, and then we planked it, and we corked it, and painted it. It was all made out of yellow cedar, which was available from the native part of the grounds we lived on. And it was a beautiful boat, well designed and well made. And we as young boys were able to learn how to sharpen tools, how to properly clamp the planking to the sides, how to do the chamfers on the ends so they have a good mortise joint fitting at the bow stem and the stern. And it was a good experience, and I learned a lot of skills.
How many teachers did you have in the school?
Well, we were in a one-room schoolhouse, and when I was in the first grade to the sixth grade, we were in the same room. So when I was in the third grade, I knew as much as the sixth graders knew, because I heard the teachers teaching them, and I was interested. So when I was in the third grade, I really had a sixth grade education.
How important was the church in the community?
That was the key point, really. The Russian Orthodox Church was the main factor and circle where we had our religious activities centered there, and also our recreational activities were part of it. And it was a portion of our life, I would say, that occupied, I'd say, 60% of our lives, because we were very devout. We believed what the preached and taught us. And we were quite obedient to the teachings of the Russian Orthodox faith. And we learned the liturgy of the services. And I could recite today the beginning to the end, because I heard it repetitiously, because they didn't change it from the time I began to when I departed.
Did you have just one priest in Ifugne?
Yes, we had Father Grossum was the priest during my period of time that I was attending there.
What do you remember about him? I've heard his name a lot.
Well, he was a neighbor of ours. We lived nearby, and he had a dog called Static, and I had a dog called Sanko. His dog was a fox terrier, my dog was a black lab. So when his dog came in my yard, I'd sick my dog against his to get him out of there. So the priest was very aware of this situation. So when I went to confession, he would tell me that, don't do this, don't sick your dog on my dog, you know. And that was one of my sins. The other sin was I would shoot birds out of the trees with my slingshot, and if that was a bad sin in as far as he was concerned. And the other thing, my brother and I used to box Gene Tunney and Max Schmeling were the boxing idols that we had, and we had a pair of boxing gloves, and we would box in our backyard, and he thought we were fighting. And so he would say, don't fight with your brother, you know. He didn't think that was a good thing to do.
So if you knew about the boxers, did you have a radio then?
Yes, we had an Atwater Kent radio with about 6B batteries and about 4A batteries. And We had no electrical power other than battery power, but we had every station in the world to listen to in the States. Like, most of the stations came in from Mexico, Tijuana, Mexico, and their ads were on patent medicine. So we used to order all that patent medicine we heard that was going to cure all things, you know, that you had. And we listened to mostly Western music. So my brothers learned how to play all those songs just by ear, by listening to the radio, and we were kept up to date of what was going on in the outside world by our radio. And we listened to KNX, which was Los Angeles, KSL, Salt Lake City, and KGO, San Francisco. And that that's a long time ago.
Hey, what is the most difficult thing you remember about living in a fog neck?
You know, I don't have any awareness of difficulty. I think when we listened to the radio, I knew there was another world out there other than where we lived, and the environment that we had was so different than what the radio announcers and the newscaster projected by radio to us. And I had this desire to see what was beyond the perimeter of a fog neck. And I had never even been to Kodiak. I think the furthest I've ever been as a child was to go to Whale Island, which was a fox ranch run by Dr. Parker. And then I came to Letnik, which was a government hatchery for salmon. And many of the people, especially the Nelson family, was employed by the Fitch hatchery over here. And that was the extent of my world. I mean, my horizon was very limited as to exposure to the geographic sections of the area.
What other communities do you think the village interacted with most?
Kodiak. A fog neck was a direct link with Kodiak. We got our supplies through Kodiak. The fish cannery in Kodiak employed most of our people. My dad was an employee of the Kodiak, Kodiak Fisheries. And we would go every summer to Kodiak to work in the canneries and then return. We'd go in May and after we planted our gardens and then return in September. And that was the real exciting part of my life when we went to Kodiak, because I got exposed to certain elements of life that was non-existent on a fog neck. Also, people from the United States, various parts, were employed at the cannery, and I would question them as to what their lives were like and what was Seattle like and what was San Francisco like. And I was really interested in other parts of the world through those contacts.
What would happen if someone got sick in the village? What kind of health care did you have?
Well, we had several sources. Dr. Parker, who was a veterinarian by training, would treat a lot of people for their minor difficulties. And if we had severe cuts and broken arms or legs, he would splint them and give them treatment. We also had Mr. Patellan, who was a store owner, and he had some training in some medical care. So consequently, like, I had a boil one time on my neck, and he heated up a bottle, and after heating it up, he put it on my neck, and when it cooled down, the vacuum pulled out all the core of that boil on my neck and then treated it with antiseptic, you know. And I don't recall having any other diseases outside of the, like, measles and chicken pox, and I had scarlet fever, I had a strep throats, and we had a lot of home remedies. My mother had all sorts of natural remedies for, like, earaches. She had a plant that she grew, I don't know what it was, but she'd put it in our ear and our earaches would go away. And we also would use packs around our necks for sore throats. And then also when we had high fevers, she would wrap us up in cloth, and it smelled vinegarish. I don't know what the solution really was, but it seemed to take our fever away.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember having midwives there to deliver the children?
I know they were in existence. Of course, when I came along, my mother went through the change of life, so I was the last child in our family. But I remember the midwife that delivered most of the babies in Fog Neck. I think there's a book written on her. But she did. But I never experienced anything beyond. I've never seen a childbirth, and we were not permitted to go to where they're having this childbirth as children.
How was the community governed? Who was in charge?
I really can't tell you that because I knew that at the grocery store, at Patellin's and Pyoman's grocery store, the elders of the village would get together and have informal talks about planning certain activities as well as discipline problems that existed. So I really don't know how the structure was, put into practice. I have no idea. I don't recall of any major crimes or any. We had a few fellows, younger guys, that make Makula, which was made out of potato mash, to create their alcohol drink, and they would get drunk on occasion, but we tolerated them, and then we knew it was going to last a short time. They usually did it during the Christmas and Easter season, you know.
So you didn't see the community as having an alcohol problem at that time?
No. The only experience I had with that were about three fellows that I was aware of that had this problem during this festive season. And they kept to themselves, the rest of the community just kind of ignored them, and they didn't bother anybody.
Can you think of any memory that makes you laugh or you think is amusing from that time period?
Well, there's various things that I think about when I recall back to my childhood. We had a boy in town, I don't recall his name, Alfred something, and he was mentally retarded. He'd go house to house with a bowl and a spoon, and people would fill his bowl with food. And he wasn't too conversive, but everybody loved him. You know, he was harmless, and we understood his situation, and they all treated him with respect. But on one occasion, when we received groceries from the outside, we would have a skiff that would load off the boat offshore. Then the skiff would come on the beach, and then we would hand carry the groceries to the stores. And I used to love to do that. And at one time, we unloaded fresh fruit, apples, oranges, and bananas, and all that, pears. And this young man purchased a pear and gave it to Nina Benjola. And in Russian, we said, Alfred Nini Persikupil, which means Alfred bought Nina a pear. And we used to tease Nina, and she would get really indignant about it, you know, that this boy that, you know, was mentally retarded would do this for her, you know. And so we used to laugh about that, you know, and she would get all upset about it. We had what they call Masquerade Week, and that's where all the local people would dress in costumes, and we'd go house to house, and you were supposed to guess who they were. And we had some real characters. Pete Nelson was one that we could never tell who he was because he always had a costume that nobody could recognize him. And instead of talking, we'd have to talk and say a few words so people could detect our voices. But he would put a rubber band between two pieces of wood and tie them together, and he would blow and talk through this little rubber band, and he disguised his voice that way, and he was quite amusing, you know. And we just loved when he came around because he made us laugh, and we could never tell it was really him, you know.
I've heard it said that there was a lot of music and dancing in Bognak.
Yes, my next door neighbor, who was Paul Tichina and related to us, had a dance hall. And it was my job just before the dance to go over there and sweep it out and put the dance hall powder on the floor to make it slick. And the fact from the people from Cut to Knee here would come over. They were very musical. They would play the banjo, the mandolin, guitar, and I think they also played the accordion. And there were other people that were talented. The Nelson family was talented. My brothers could play different instruments. And none of them had official lessons in music, but they all listened by ear, and they can duplicate anything they heard on a radio. You know, it was really amazing. And so we could play the schottisches and the polkas and all those foxtrots and all those waltzes. And everybody knew how to dance, because when we finished supper at our home, everybody cleaned up. We washed the dishes, we put them away, we swept the floor, and we arranged the furniture, and then we removed our oriental rug from the floor, and we made a space for dancing. And my sisters would teach all of us brothers how to dance, the schottische and the polka and the waltz and the two-step and all that sort of thing. So when we went to the dance, we knew how to do it. And everybody was a good dancer in a Fognak. And then the special thing that was happening with the men and the older, well, it was the... My sisters were probably in their teens when they would have these baskets of food that they would make and decorate these boxes, and then the men they would auction them off or bid on these boxes, and the highest bidder would get to dance with the person that made the food basket. And my sisters always won because they made the fanciest basket and they had the best food in there, and the guys knew it, you know, and so they always. Their boxes were the first ones to go, and that was quite an event, you know. And we had a lot of festive occasions there, and my mom and dad were good dancers, and all the rest of my brothers and sisters learned how to dance, you know.
So when you were 12 years old, you had to move to Kodiak to go to school, so you finished your schooling in Kodiak?
Yes, I did. I graduated in 1941 from Kodiak High School, this foreigner graduating class, and then I went to Seattle upon graduation in September of that fall after the canning season was over with, and went to Seattle to go to the University of Washington. But 1941, as you know, was a declaration of war on Japan, and that changed my whole educational plans for. Whereas I didn't go to the university, I went to the United States Merchant Marine Academy instead, because my brother advised me that if I took that training, I would have a good career opportunity. And so I listened to him and did that.
So you said there were four in your graduating class. Who were the other three?
Well, we had Roy Mattson, Noreen Johnson, Theo Malutin, and did I say Noreen Johnson? Yeah. And so all of them, those four, were all successful in life after they graduated. You know, it was really amazing. Yeah.
Where were you when you heard about the tidal wave in 1964?
I can't recall where I was in 1964. Yes, I was working for W.R. Grace and Company as their marine superintendent for their tanker fleet, which hauled LPG gas, ammonia, propane, and butane. And they were worldwide coverage and sales for these products. And our main factories were located in Trinidad, Aruba, and Big Springs, Texas, and Memphis, Tennessee. And my ships delivered ammonia throughout the whole world. And my job was to keep those tanks at a level where the capacity of the plants would not be shut down due to the storage tank being overfilled, so they wouldn't have any shutdown, so had a schedule problem to maintain at all times. So I had made long deliveries and to various parts in the world that would kind of mess up our schedule to a degree, but we somehow managed to keep the plants going without having a major shutdown, because if you shut ammonia plant down, the high temperatures and pressures involved there would do serious damage to the heat exchangers on the process system. And it cost $1 million to have a shutdown, because we'd have to replace all these high expansion joints that would not withstand the temperature variation. So it was quite a tricky job to maintain the schedule and keep those plants going.
Oh, I was going to ask you what your reaction was when you heard that the village had been wiped out and all the damage here when you were somewhere else.
Well, it was hard for me to visualize the destruction till I saw the pictures of it. And the newspapers covered it well, and the radio and television was transmitted in the areas where I lived. And so it was quite devastating to me to think that the village that I was born and raised in was destroyed.
So will this trip be the first time you've been back to the old village?
Yes. Uh-huh. I haven't been in this village since I departed at age 12. Mm. I'm 75 now.
And you currently live in Arizona?
Yes, yes.
Is there anything that I didn't ask you about that you particularly would like to share?
Well, my sons and I were talking this morning on the beach. My son wanted to go fishing at Letnik there, and we were talking about the structure of the buildings in Afognik. If you take a picture of the Afognik village and you compare it with the structures in Norway and Sweden, they would be similar in design. So the Nordic influence was predominant in the old village. Because I live with a guy right now, temporarily, while we're visiting Seattle, who is from Norway. He has a picture of his village where he was born and raised. And you could say that was the Afognik, the way it looks.
So you think the Scandinavian influence was as much as the Russian influence?
Oh, yes, predominantly. The Russian influence was there in language and in custom of tradition for eating, and the church influence was there. However, the skills of the Nordic people, they were carpenters, they were bricklayers. These skills showed up in the structures that they built here, you know, because we even had fireplaces. We had banyas that were made with locally made brick, and they were well designed, and everything was neatly done. You know, and it wasn't a makeshift job. It was well designed and properly maintained, properly designed for maintenance too. You know.
Well, it sounds like it was quite a place.
It was.
Well, thank you very much for talking with me, and I hope we can speak some more later.
Yeah, thank you.